Chapter 22. The scream came from the window of the Goldberg family. Ravitch listened for a moment. It seemed to him hardly possible that old man Goldberg had flung something at his wife or beaten her. Nor did he hear anything more. Only the sound of running, then a short, excited conversation in the room of the refugee Wiesenhoff and the slamming of doors. Immediately afterwards there was a knock at his door, and the proprietress rushed in.
"Quick, quick, Monsieur Goldberg!"
"What?"
"He's hanged himself, in the window. Quick!"
Ravitch threw down his book. "Are the police here?"
"Of course not. Otherwise I wouldn't have called you. She has just found him."
Ravitch ran downstairs with her. "Have they cut him down?"
"Not yet. They are holding him."
In the twilight room, a dark group was standing by the window. Ruth Goldberg, the refugee Wiesenhoff, and someone else. Ravitch turned the light on. Wiesenhoff and Ruth Goldberg held old Goldberg in their arms like a puppet, and the third man was nervously trying to loosen the knot of a tie that was fastened to the window bolt.
"Cut him down."
"We haven't a knife,"
Ruth Goldberg shouted. Ravitch got a pair of scissors out of his bag and began to cut. The tie was made of smooth, thick, heavy silk, and it took a few seconds before it was severed. As he worked, Ravitch had Goldberg's face close in front of him, the protruding eyes, the open mouth, the thin grey beard, the thick tongue, the dark green tie with white dots cutting deep into the scrawny, swollen throat. The body oscillated in Wiesenhoff's and Ruth Goldberg's arms as if it were swaying back and forth in a frightful, frozen laughter. Ruth Goldberg's face was red and flooded with tears. Beside her, Wiesenhoff sweated under the burden of the body, which was heavier than ever in life. Two wet, horrified, sobbing faces, and above them, silently grinning into the beyond, the gently rolling head which, as Ravitch cut the tie, fell against Ruth Goldberg, so that she started back, screaming, dropped her arms, and the body slid sideways with sprawling arms and seemed to follow her in a grotesque, clown-like movement. Ravitch caught the body and put it on the floor with Wiesenhoff's help. He loosened the noose and began his examination.
"To the movies," Ruth Goldberg jabbered. "He sent me to the movies. Ruthie," he said, "you get so little entertainment. Why don't you go to the Theatre Gourcelle? There's a Garbo picture on, Queen Christine. Why don't you go and see it? Take a good seat. Take a fauteuil or a loge. Go and see it. 2 hours away from misery is something, after all." He said it calmly and kindly and patted my cheeks. "And afterwards go and have a chocolate and vanilla ice cream in front of the café on the Parc Monceau. Have a good time for once, Ruthie," he said. "And I went, and when I came back, there—"
Ravitch got up. Ruth Goldberg stopped talking. "He must have done it right after you left," he said. She pressed her fists against her mouth.
"Is he—"
"We can still try. First artificial respiration. Do you know anything about it?" Ravitch asked Wiesenhoff.
"No, not too much. Something."
"Look here." Ravitch took Goldberg's arms, drew them backward to the floor, then forward, pressing them against his chest, and backward and forward again. There was a rattling in Goldberg's throat.
"He's alive!" the woman screamed.
"No, that's the compressed windpipe." Ravitch demonstrated the movement a few more times. "So, try it now," he said to Wiesenhoff. Reluctantly, Wiesenhoff knelt behind Goldberg.
"Go ahead," Ravitch said impatiently. "Hold him by the wrists, or better yet, by the forearms."
Wiesenhoff was sweating.
"Harder," Ravitch said. "Press all the air out of his lungs."
He turned toward the proprietress. Meanwhile, more people had come into the room. He motioned to the proprietress to leave. "He's dead," he said in the corridor. "What's going on inside is nonsense, a ritual that has to be gone through, nothing else. It would be a miracle if anything helped now."
"What shall we do?"
"The usual thing.
Ambulance? First aid? That means the police 10 minutes later."
"You have to call the police anyhow. Did the Goldbergs have papers?"
"Yes, valid ones. Passports and carte d'identité."
"Wiesenhoff?"
"Permit to stay. Extended visa."
"Then they are all right. Tell both of them not to mention that I was there. She came home, found him, screamed. Wiesenhoff cut him down and tried artificial respiration until the ambulance came. Can you do that?" The proprietress looked at him with her bird-like eyes.
"Of course. I'll be there anyhow when the police come. I'll take good care.
Fine. They went back. Wiesenhoff was bending over Goldberg and working. For a moment it seemed as if both were doing gymnastics on the floor. The proprietress remained standing at the door.
Mesdames et messieurs, she said, I must call the ambulance and the police. I'll call the ambulance first. The orderly or doctor who comes with it will have to inform the police immediately. They will be here in half an hour at the latest. Any of you who hasn't papers had better pack his things right away, at least those lying around, carry them to the catacombs and stay down there. It's possible that the police will search the rooms or ask for witnesses.
The room emptied immediately. The proprietress nodded to Ravitch that she would instruct Ruth Goldberg and Wiesenhoff. He picked up his bag and the scissors lying on the floor by the cut tie. The tie lay there with the store label showing, S. Ferder, Berlin. It was a tie that had cost at least 10 marks. From Goldberg's prosperous days, Ravitch knew the firm. He had made purchases there himself. He quickly put his belongings into a couple of suitcases and took them into Morozov's room. It was a precaution only. Very likely the police would not bother about anything, but it was better. The memory of Fernand still smarted in Ravitch's mind. He went down to the catacombs. A number of people were running about excitedly. They were the refugees without papers. The illegal brigade. Clarisse, the waitress, and Jean, the waiter, were directing the placing of the suitcases in a vault-like room adjoining the catacombs. The catacombs themselves were in readiness for supper. The tables were set, bread baskets stood here and there, and a smell of fat and fish came from the kitchen.
"Take your time," Jean said to the nervous refugees. "The police are not so prompt."
The refugees were taking no chances. They were not used to luck. They bustled hastily into the cellar with their few belongings. The Spaniard Alvarez was among them. The proprietress had sent word through the entire hotel that the police were coming. Alvarez smiled at Ravitch almost apologetically. Ravitch did not know why. A thin man placidly approached him. It was Ernst Seidenbaum, doctor of philology and philosophy.
"Manoeuvres," he said to Ravitch. "Dress rehearsal. Will you stay in the catacombs?"
"No." Seidenbaum, a veteran of the last 6 years, shrugged his shoulders.
"I'll stay. I'm not in the mood to run away. I don't think they'll do more than take down evidence in the case. Who is interested in an old dead German Jew?"
"Not in him, but in live illegal refugees." Seidenbaum adjusted his pince-nez.
"It makes no difference to me. Do you know what I did during the last raid? At that time a sergeant even came down into the catacombs, more than 2 years ago. I put on one of Jean's white jackets and served at table, brandy for the police."
"Good idea." Seidenbaum nodded. "The time comes for everyone when he has had enough of running away." He calmly strolled into the kitchen to find out what there would be for supper. Ravitch went through the back door of the catacombs across the yard. A cat ran by, brushed against his feet. The others walked in front of him. They quickly dispersed on the street. Alvarez was limping a little.
"Maybe that could be remedied by an operation," Ravitch thought absent-mindedly. He was sitting on the Place des Ternes, and suddenly he had the feeling that Joan would come this night. He could not say why. He simply knew it suddenly. He paid for his supper and walked slowly back to the hotel. It was warm, and in the narrow streets the signs of the hotels which rent rooms by the hour blazed red in the early night. Slits of light gleamed from behind curtained windows. A group of sailors were following several whores. They were young and loud and hot with wine and summer. They disappeared into one of the hotels. The music of a harmonica was coming from somewhere. A thought like a rocket shot up in Ravitch, unfolded, spread above him, and plucked a magic landscape out of the dark. Joan waiting for him at the hotel to tell him that she had put everything behind her and was coming back. He stood still. "What's the matter with me?" he thought. "Why am I standing here? And why do my hands touch the air as if it were the nape of a neck and a wave of hair? Too late. One can't summon anything back. No one comes back. Just as the once-lived hour never returns." He walked on to the hotel, across the yard to the back door of the catacombs. At the door, he noticed a number of people sitting inside.
Seidenbaum was among them, not as a waiter, as a guest. The danger seemed to be over. He entered. Morozov was in his room.
"I was just going to leave," he said. "I thought you were off to Switzerland again when I saw your suitcases."
"Is everything all right?"
"Yes, the police aren't coming back. They have released the corpse, a simple case. The body is upstairs. They are laying it out now."
"Good. Then I can move back into my room." Morozov laughed.
"That's Seidenbaum," he said. "He was there the whole time, with a briefcase containing some papers or other in his pince-nez. He presented himself as a lawyer and representative of the insurance company. He was rather rough with the police. He saved old man Goldberg's passport, claimed he would need it. The police were entitled to his carte d'identité only. He got away with it."
"Has he any papers himself?"
"Not a scrap." "Fine," Morozov declared. "The passport is worth its weight in gold. It's valid for another year. Someone can live on it. Not in Paris, exactly, unless he's as daring as Seidenbaum. The photograph can easily be changed. There are inexpensive experts who will change the date of birth in case the new Aaron Goldberg should be younger. A modern kind of transmigration of souls, a passport valid for several lives."
"Then Seidenbaum will be called Goldberg from now on?"
"Well, not Seidenbaum. He rejected it. It is beneath his dignity. He is the Don Quixote among the world's citizens of the underground. He's too fatalistic and too curious about what will happen to men of his type to want it falsified by a borrowed passport. How about you?"
Ravitch shook his head. "Not for me. I'm on Seidenbaum's side." He took his suitcases and walked upstairs. In the corridor where the Goldbergs lived, he was passed by an old Jew in a black caftan, with a beard and sidelocks, who had the face of a biblical patriarch. The old man walked soundlessly, as if on rubber soles, and he seemed to float through the dimly lit corridor, vague and wan. He opened Goldberg's door. For a moment, a reddish light, as though from candles, emanated from inside, and Ravitch heard a strange, half-suppressed, half-wild, monotonous wailing that was almost melodious. Professional women mourners, he thought. Could something like that still exist? Or was it only Ruth Goldberg? He opened his door and saw Joan sitting by the window. She jumped up.
"There you are. What has happened? Why do you have your suitcases with you? Do you have to leave again?"
Ravitch put the suitcases beside the bed. "Nothing is the matter. It was only a precaution. Someone died. The police had to come. Everything is all right again."
"I called you up. Someone at the telephone said you did not live here any longer."
"That was our landlady, cautious and smart, as always."
"I rushed here. The room was open and empty. Your things weren't here. I thought, Ravitch—"
Her voice trembled. Ravitch smiled with an effort. "You see, I am an unreliable creature, nothing to build on." There was a knock at the door. Morozov came in, a couple of bottles in his hand.
"Ravitch, you forgot your ammunition."
He noticed Joan standing in the dark and acted as though he did not see her. Ravitch did not know whether he had recognized her at all. He handed the bottles to Ravitch and left without coming in. Ravitch put the Calvados and Vouvray on the table. Through the open window he heard the voice he had heard in the corridor, the wailing for the dead. It grew louder, ebbed away, and began again. Very likely the windows at Goldberg's were standing open in the warm night, in which old Aaron's rigid body was now slowly beginning to disintegrate in the room with the mahogany furniture.
"Ravitch," Joan said, "I'm sad. I don't know why. I have been all day. Let me stay here."
He did not answer immediately. He felt taken by surprise. He had expected it otherwise, not so direct. "How long?" he asked.
"Until tomorrow."
"That's not long enough." She sat down on the bed.
"Can't we forget that for once?"
"No, Joan."
"I don't want anything. I merely want to sleep at your side. Or let me sleep on the sofa."
"It won't do. Besides, I have to leave for the hospital."
"That doesn't matter. I'll wait for you. I've done that often enough."
He did not answer. He was surprised that he was so calm. The warmth and excitement he had felt on the street had disappeared.
"And you don't have to go to the hospital?"
Jones said. He remained silent for a moment. He knew if he slept with her he was lost. It was like signing a check for which there were no funds. She would come again and again and stand on what she had gained as on her rights, and she would ask for a little more every time without yielding anything herself until he was completely in her hands and she would finally become bored and leave him then, a victim of his own weakness and his shattered desires, weak and thoroughly corrupt. She did not intend it. She was not even aware of it. But it would happen that way. It was simple to think that one night would make no difference. But every time one lost part of one's resistance and part of what should never be corrupted in life. Sins against the Holy Ghost, the Catholic Catechism called that, with strange and cautionary dread, and added darkly, in contradiction to its entire dogma, that they would not be forgiven in this life or in the life to come. "It is true," Ravitch said. "I do not have to go to the hospital. But I don't want you to stay here." He expected an outbreak, but she only said calmly, "Why not?" Should he try to explain it to her? Was he able to do it at all? "You no longer belong here," he said. "I do belong here." "No." "Why not?" How smart she is, he thought. Simply by questioning him she forced explanations, and who explained was already on the defensive. "You know," he said. "Don't ask so foolishly." "You no longer want me?" "No," he replied, and added against his will, "Not this way." The monotonous wailing came through the window from Goldberg's room, the lamentation for the dead, the grief of the shepherds of Lebanon in a Parisian side street. "Ravitch," Joan said, "you must help me. I can help you best by leaving you alone, and you me." She paid no attention. "You've got to help me. I could tell you lies, but I don't want to any more. Yes, there is someone. But it is different than with you. If it were the same, I wouldn't be here." Ravitch took a cigarette out of his pocket. He felt the dry paper. There it was now. Now he knew. It was like a cool knife that did not hurt. Certainty never hurts, only the before and after. "It is never the same," he said, "and it is always the same." "What cheap stuff I talk," he thought. "Newspaper paradoxes. How shabby the truth can become when one articulates it." Joan straightened up. "Ravitch," she said, "you know it is not true that one can love only one person. There are those who can only do that. They are happy. And there are others who are thrown into confusion. You know that." He lit his cigarette. Without glancing at her, he knew what Joan looked like now. Pale, her eyes dark, silent, concentrated, almost beseeching, frail, and never to be overcome. That was how she had looked in her apartment that afternoon, like an angel of the Annunciation, full of faith and radiant conviction, an angel pretending to save while she attempted to crucify one slowly so that one would not escape her. "Yes," he said, "it is one of our excuses." "It is no excuse. One is not happy doing it. One is pitched into it and can't help it. It is something sinister, a maze of things, a spasm, something you have got to go through. You can't run away. It comes after you. It catches up with you. You don't want it, but it is stronger."
"Why do you think about it? Follow it, if it is stronger."
"That's what I am doing. I know there is nothing else I can do."
"But," her voice changed, "Ravitch, I must not lose you. I don't know what it is, but I can't lose you."
Ravitch smoked and did not taste the smoke. "You don't want to lose me," he thought. "Nor the other man either. That's it, that you are able to do such a thing. That's why I must get away from you. It isn't the one man, that could be quickly forgotten. You had every excuse for it. But that it has got hold of you so that you can't get away, that's the thing. You will get away. But it will happen again. It will happen time and again. It is in you. I too could do that earlier. I can't do it with you. That's why I must get away from you. Now I may still be able to do it. Next time." "You think it is an extraordinary situation," he said. "It is the commonest in the world, the husband and the lover." "That's not true." "It is.
It has many variations. Yours is one of them.
How can you say anything like that?
She jumped up.
You are anything but that, and you never were, and you'll never be. The other one is much more...
She interrupted herself.
No, it isn't that way either. I can't explain it.
Let's say security and adventure. It sounds better. It is the same. You want to have one and don't want to let go the other. She shook her head.
Ravitch, she said, out of the dark in a voice that moved his heart. One can use good words for it and bad ones. It doesn't change anything. I love you, and I'll love you till the end of my life. That I know, and that is clear to me. You are the horizon, and all my thoughts end in you. Whatever happens is still always within you. It is no deceit. It takes nothing from you. That's why I come to you again and again, and that's why I can't regret it, and why I can't feel guilty.
There is no guilt in feelings ever, Joan. What made you think of such a thing?
I have thought it over. I have thought so much about it, Ravitch, about you and about myself. You never wholly wanted me. Perhaps you don't realize it yourself. There was always something that was closed off from me. I could never get completely into you. I wanted to. How much I wanted to. It was always as if you might go away any minute. I never felt sure. The fact that the police sent you away, that you had to leave, it might just as well have happened in another way, that you would have gone one day on your own, that you would simply not have been here any more, off somewhere.
Ravitch stared at the face in the uncertain dark before him. There was something right in what she said.
It was always that way, she continued, always. And then someone came who wanted me, nothing but me, wholly and forever, without any complications. I laughed. I did not want it. I played with it. It seemed so harmless, so easy to push aside again. And then suddenly it became more, a compulsion. Also there was something within me that wanted too. I resisted, but it did not help. I did not belong there, and not everything within me wanted it, a part of me only. But it pushed me. It was like a slow landslide which one laughs at in the beginning, and suddenly there is nothing left to hold on to, and you can't resist any longer. But I don't belong there, Ravitch. I belong to you.
He threw his cigarette out the window. It flew like a glowworm down into the yard. What has happened, Joan, he said. We can't change it now.
I don't want to change anything. It will pass. I belong to you. Why do I come back again? Why do I stand before your door? Why do I wait for you here, and you throw me out, and I will come again? I know you won't believe it, and you think I have other reasons. What reasons, then? If this other thing satisfied me, I would not have come back. I'd have forgotten you. You say what I look for with you is security. That's not true. It is love.
Words, Ravitch thought. Sweet words. Gentle, deceptive balm. Help, love, to belong together, to come back again. Words, sweet words, nothing but words. How many words existed for this simple, wild, cruel attraction of two bodies? What a rainbow of imagination, lies, sentiment, and self-deception enclosed it. There he stood on this farewell night. There he stood, calm, in the dark. And he let this rain of sweet words trickle over him, words that meant nothing but farewell, farewell, farewell. When one talked about it, it was already lost. The god of love had a blood-stained forehead. He did not know anything about words.
You must go now, Joan.
She got up.
I want to stay here. Let me stay here, only tonight.
He shook his head.
What do you take me for? I'm not an automaton.
She leaned against him. He felt her trembling.
It doesn't matter. Let me stay here.
He pushed her gently away. You shouldn't start with me just to deceive the other man. He'll have to suffer enough without that.
I can't go home alone now.
You won't have to be alone for long.
I will. I am alone. For days now. He's away. He isn't in Paris.
So, Ravitch replied calmly. He looked at her. Well, at least you are candid. One knows where one stands with you.
That's not why I came.
Of course not.
There was no need for me to tell you.
Right.
Ravitch, I don't want to go home alone.
Then I'll take you home.
She slowly took one step backward.
"You don't love me any more,"
she said softly and almost threateningly. "Did you come to find that out?"
"Yes, that too. Not only that, but that was part of it."
"My God, Joan," Ravitch replied impatiently, "then you have just heard one of the most candid confessions of love." She did not answer. She looked at him. "Do you think that otherwise I would mind keeping you here, no matter who you're living with?" he said. Slowly she began to smile. It wasn't really a smile. It was a radiance from within, as if someone had lit a lamp in her and the glow was gradually mounting to her eyes.
"Thank you, Ravitch," she said.
And after a while, warily, still looking at him,
"You won't leave me?"
"Why do you ask?"
"You'll wait. You won't leave me?"
"I think there is not much danger, to judge by my experience with you."
"Thank you."
She was changed. How quickly she consoles herself, he thought. But why shouldn't she? She thought she had gained what she wanted even without staying there. She kissed him.
"I knew you would be this way, Ravitch. You had to be this way. Now I'll go. Don't take me home. Now I can go alone."
She stood by the door. "Don't come again," he said. "And don't think about anything. You won't perish."
"No." "Good night, Ravitch."
"Good night, Joan." He went to the wall and turned on the light. "You have to be this way." He shook himself slightly. "They are made of clay and gold," he thought, "of lies and infatuation, of deception and shameless truth." He sat down by the window. From below still came the low, monotonous wailing. A woman who had deceived her husband and was bewailing him because he was dead. But perhaps only because her religion prescribed it. Ravitch wondered that he was not more unhappy.